For the brokenness of the daughter of my people, I am broken. I mourn, and the horror has seized me. Is there no balm in Gilead? For yet another incident of gun violence in our streets that has left three people dead, including a Toronto police officer, we mourn and cry out, is there no balm in Gilead? For the growing gap between rich and poor, for the rise of precarious employment, for more and more people needing to choose between food and rent, we mourn and cry out, is there no balm in Gilead? For the lack of leadership in housing policy that allows towers to rise into the skies with no affordable options, for a broken shelter system and people sleeping in parks and underneath bridges, we mourn and cry out, is there no balm in Gilead? For the despair and anger, especially amongst the young, of a future robbed by climate change, we mourn and cry out, is there no balm in Gilead? For the epidemics of loneliness and isolation, for the rise of addictions and the fracturing of families, we mourn and cry out, is there no balm in Gilead? For Putin's war in the Ukraine, for any time we take up arms against each other, for each case of PTSD, we mourn and cry out, is there no balm in Gilead? For the murdered and missing Indigenous women, for intergenerational trauma, for the broken treaties, we mourn and cry out, is there no balm in Gilead? For performative allyship, for social media outrage, for gotcha politics and the decimation of cooperation, dialogue, and basic common decency, we mourn and cry out, is there no balm in Gilead? For the loss of habitat, for the clear cut of trees, for the plight of bees, and for islands of plastic in our seas, we mourn and cry out, is there no balm in Gilead? Responding to a nation hell-bent on self-destruction, the prophet Jeremiah plays the role of public griever and social critic. He laments the state of his nation and wonders out loud if restoration is even possible at this point. Can anything heal this people? Have we gone beyond the point of no return? For Jeremiah, the sickness he saw around him was chronic. It was pervasive. It had metastasized into every cell of social, economic, and religious life. The idolatry of wealth and power, the oppression of the poor and the outcast, the sin of inequity all revealed a culture of systemic injustice with no hint of divine economy. For Jeremiah, the disease affecting the life of the people is beyond human skill of any human physician. It is a disease of the spirit. It is a sickness of the soul. The Hungarian-Canadian physician and author Gábor Máté has penned a new book called The Myth of Normal: Trauma, Illness, and Healing in a Toxic Culture. As the title suggests, Dr. Máté's thesis is that we are sick because our culture is sick. The chronic mental and physical illnesses that so many of us deal with are often either caused by or exacerbated by chronic societal ills that pervade every aspect of our lives. Amid spectacular economic, technological, and medical resources, countless humans suffer illnesses born of stress, ignorance, inequality, environmental degradation, climate change, poverty, and social isolation. Millions of people die prematurely of diseases we know how to prevent, or of deprivations we have more than enough resources to eliminate. Think malaria in the global south or the AIDS crisis in Africa. Closer to home, as Dr. Máté records, in the United States, the richest country in history and the epicenter of the globalized economic system, 60% of adults have a chronic disorder such as high blood pressure or diabetes. In Canada, half of all baby boomers are on track for hypertension within a few years if current trends continue. Thanks to globalization, China has now entered a new era of obesity. Throughout the world, mental health issues are escalating amongst every age group, the young, adults, and among the elderly. In Canada, depression and anxiety are the fastest growing diagnoses, and in 2019, more than 50 million Americans reported suffering an episode of mental illness. Children are feeling abandoned by governments and adults on climate action. Despondency and hopelessness and chronic stressors will have significant, long-lasting negative impacts on the mental health of our youth. From Jeremiah's time to ours, every generation has had to deal with challenges. But what is unique about this particular moment is the speed in which everything is happening. Because of our technology and the fire hose approach to media content, it feels like everything is happening all at once. Even if a particular issue is able to break through the noise, another thing pushes it out of the way almost immediately. We have no time for thought or discernment or dialogue or lament. All we can do is react, often hyper-emotionally. It's always next and next and next and next, where it is impossible to keep up, impossible to breathe. Ours is a culture of dis-ease. Ours is a culture of dis-ease, and it is making us sick. For the brokenness of the daughter of my people, I am broken. I mourn, and horror has seized me. Is there no balm in Gilead? When Jesus taught, he taught in parables. Short stories where the disciples and the crowds would need to find their own understandings. He offered open narratives that invite us to engage with them in our own way. Each of us will hear a distinct message in parables, which may change based on the context, where we are in our lives, on our faith journey, and the issues we are dealing with as a people. The parable of the dishonest manager found in Luke 16 is generally considered to be the most confusing of Jesus' parables. In preparation for today, I went to the commentaries and the scholarly journals, and I can report that there is no consensus on its interpretation, which I think makes it a really interesting parable. There are so many threads we could follow. We could dig into the perspective of the manager himself or the wealthy master, or perhaps the original hearers of the parable, which in this case would have been the crowds and the Pharisees. But for this particular moment in time, I think the most compelling perspective is that of those with the most at stake, but the least amount of power. In this passage, we find a rich man whose lifestyle is made possible by the income made from his estate in the country run by peasant tenant farmers. The farmer's rent to the landowner is exorbitant, and they have no option but to purchase basic supplies from the company store he also owns. The harvest is never enough to both pay the rent and purchase what the families need. The tenant farmer slipped deeper and deeper into debt at exploitative interest rates, forcing them to work harder and harder and harder to pay what cannot be paid. The steward, whom the owner has hired, is a notch above the peasant farmers on the social ladder. When he gets into trouble, the families are not likely to take him in because he has used his position of authority to deal unjustly with them and perpetuate an economic system guaranteed to keep them in poverty. Now, Jewish history is full of peasant revolts over issues like poverty and exploitation, which were bloody affairs and almost always resulted in worse conditions for common people than before. Because they were virtually powerless, the common people needed to find ways of resisting their oppressors that did not subject them to the jeopardy of open revolt. So they would engage in forms of passive noncompliance, like the slow payment of debts that we see in this parable. Finding themselves within an exploitative system, the peasants would push back, using the only tool at their disposal, their non-participation. When the manager reduced their debts to reasonable levels, the farmers were more than happy to pay. Even though this act was entirely self-serving on behalf of the manager, because of it, the farmers could see hope beginning to emerge. Maybe they could now have agency in other aspects of their lives, to buy some extra seed to feed their families, to purchase a herd of livestock of their own, to take on help to lighten the burdens. For them, the hope had emerged, the hope that had emerged was a hope born in their resistance to exploitation. Perhaps you, like me, can hear echoes of this type of resistance to what many young people these days are referring to as quiet quitting. Quiet quitting. It's a term that has been twisted by some commentators to insinuate that young people are lazy and don't want to work. But in truth, the intention is, in fact, opposite of that. What quiet quitting is about is it's about working diligently for the job you were hired for, but not buying into the exploitative culture that demands or guilts you into feeling that you must habitually give more and more and more. It means to go quiet in your off time, to say no to chronically working late or on weekends, to quit answering emails and texts and phone calls outside of scheduled work hours. Quiet quitting is a pushback, often by people with very little power in corporate structures, to the pressure to be always on and to never have time for yourself or your family. It is a resistance to the system of exploitation that you need to constantly give and give and give and give based on some future promise of economic gain and stability. A promise that all too often ends up being a lie and only ends up serving those who have already had, who already have wealth and stability. Quiet quitting is about setting healthy boundaries and redefining what success looks like. That we are more than our jobs or societal expectations, that there is a deeper reality beyond the crush of the rush. Even when we feel small in the face of the powers and principalities of this world, we do have agency. We do have power in the form of our choices. We can push back in our own ways against a culture of toxicity that is making us sick. As Christians, we are called to promote and build a different kind of economy. Money may serve mission, but it should never be the mission. We cannot serve both God and money. In his parable of the dishonest manager, I think Jesus is saying that we need to be wise in the ways of the world, using all the tools available to us, our choices, our technology, our creativity, our money, to help manifest an economy of healing and wholeness, whose currency is the double-headed coin of justice and love. We are called to help manifest a culture based not on greed and exploitation, but on the free-flowing exchange of mercy and kindness and decency that affirms the deeper reality of an ever-emerging God, that affirms the deeper reality of an ever-emerging God. The Message version of 1 Timothy chapter 2 says this: "The first thing I want you to do is pray. Pray every way you know how, for everyone you know. Pray especially for rulers and their governments to rule well so we can be quietly about our business of living simply in humble contemplation. This is the way our Savior God wants us to live. The first thing I want you to do is pray." Even when we are feeling small or overwhelmed or alone or not sure what to do or where to turn, this is where we start. God has not abandoned this sin-sick world. Even in these days of sickness and strife, toxicity and turmoil, we put our faith in God in prayer. Prayer is an act of resistance. It is a holy choice, where we seek a deeper reality and enter into God's economy of healing and wholeness. Prayer unites us as God's beloved children, including those with influence who have a special responsibility to use their power wisely. While prayer may include our own needs, it also opens us up to the needs of others. It extends our heart outwards so that we may act with wisdom and with courage. when the world says go faster and faster and wants more and more and more from us, we can resist, we can push back, we can say no, we can stop the cycles, we can turn our hearts over to God in quiet listening and reflection. When the world says you must climb the ladder of wealth and status, we can fall to our knees at the cross of Christ. We can fall to our knees at the cross of Christ because it is there. It is there that the God of mercy meets us and raises us to new life. It is there that God meets us and sends us out to be a healing balm for a hurting world. There is a balm in Gilead to make the wounded whole. There is a balm in Gilead to heal the sin-sick soul. May it be so.